We are back with the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell and I are talking with Dennis Hayes in Oberlin, Ohio. And you ask, why Oberlin, Ohio? Dennis Hayes, why are we all in Oberlin, Ohio?
Well, we're not just in Oberlin, but we're in the Lewis Environmental Studies Center, where Bill McDonough and his team of architects have built a building that we hope will be one of the milestones in first changing the universities of the country and then the country into something that becomes energy self-sufficient. This is a building that is already super energy efficient, and it's still in a process of evolution. They will be adding photovoltaic arrays and fine-tuning their systems. And a few years from now, we hope it will be entirely energy self-sufficient. And by 2020, a group of students here at Oberlin are bringing pressure on the administration to have the entire campus be energy self-sufficient and carbon dioxide neutral.
Well, I ask that specifically. Yes, Bill, you do get to talk. It's true, you do. But it's almost as if part of your book has come to life. It's almost as if some of your agenda, when you talk about the Guide to Planet Repair, they're doing some of the stuff you talk about, aren't they?
Well, there's a long history, not only in environmentalism, but in most movements of youth taking the lead, whether it's an anti-war movement or a civil rights movement or an environmental movement. Here at Oberlin, people are taking the lead. At Tufts University, at Harvard, at University of Washington, there are efforts. The thing that came out of Tufts, for example, they basically took a look and said, why should we care whether or not the Senate ratifies the Kyoto Protocol on climate change? If they ratify it, somebody's just then going to have to implement it. So let's go implement it, whether they ratify it or not, and began their own sort of feisty process to do that. And as they make progress at Tufts, they reached out to other schools, and now they're trying to get hospitals and shopping centers and commercial buildings to make similar sorts of commitments. Kids often don't know that things can't get done, and that's a wonderful advantage in the world.
You had a remarkable amount of success with the first Earth Day. It was startling how successful it was.
That was 1970.
And it was interesting to watch the energy that went into that and the broad support from all parts of the community. The good news is that a lot happened. The bad news is it looked like we'd won the war because so many people got involved and some very important legislation was passed. And then, you know, being linear thinkers, as most of us are, point thinkers, whichever. You know, the tendency is assume that we had set ourselves in a direction, and this, you know, all we had to do was keep proceeding and down or up the path that we had set, and that by now everything would be fine. I looked at your book that was published, I think, in 1977, that had laid out a list of things that needed to be done, and you know, scenarios looking forward as much as two decades from 1977. And things, you know, we had the opportunity to have things be a lot better in 1997, and you laid out an array of things that could be done and policies that had been implemented, directions that had been set, research that was being done. And yet here we are in the year 2000 without having solved a lot of those kinds of things. Where did we go astray?
Oh,
you can tell the truth.
Thanks for that softball question. Let's where we started to go astray is crystal clear. What that book was talking about was energy efficiency and the development of renewable energy resources. In the closing months of the Carter administration, they formally embraced a goal of having the nation 20% powered by renewable energy resources, and with more than a doubling of the efficiency of energy use by the year 2000, and laid out in rather thorough detail the strategy to get there, and then lost the election. And what happened was that Ronald Reagan dismantled it systematically. My own particular little niche at that point was I was running a major research institute, the precursor to what is now the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, that when Carter left office, we were doing more research on solar, wind, and biological energy resources than the rest of the world combined. That's not very much. It was only like 130 million in 1978, 79 dollars. Reagan came in and reduced it by $100 million. Fired more than half of my staff in one afternoon in a fashion that was brutal. People that I had spent months persuading to give up tenured professorships to become part of this Manhattan Project for the good guys were treated so shabbily. I mean, I spent the next year of my life writing letters of recommendation to try to get people placed once again. And then there was a period when hope began to spring again with the election of Clinton and Gore. A number of initiatives came out, as you'll recall, in the first 6 months with Bruce Babbitt sort of right out at the cutting edge on a number of resource and environmental issues. Bruce Babbitt being sort of the anti-James Watt. It was a wonderful period of hope, and all that kind of began to unwind and then unwound with a vengeance after the 1994 election, when suddenly both houses of Congress were in the hands of people who, as part of the contract with America, had a robust anti-environmental agenda. And basically for the last 6 years, the environmental movement has been playing defense. Rather than trying to continue to make the kind of progress we were aspiring toward before, we're spending most of our energy and money trying to ward off horrible things that would roll back the triumphs of the last 30 years.
That suggests that, Tufts aside, that there still is a role for government and a role for public policy, that we can't just be good citizens in our local communities and ignore politics.
And leave it to the kids to fix it.
No. I mean, let's take a recent decision by government that, and look at the implications of it. The California Air Resources Board has been for some years demanding that there be zero emissions vehicles as a fraction of the fleet sold in California, with a series of milestones and deadlines, and they abandoned their first milestone, but kept the pressure on saying that the second and third would be met, and they abandoned their second milestone, and then there became this huge pressure to abandon the third, and there they put their backs up. They said, we've given you the time, we've given you the flexibility, we expect to have a large fraction of cars being sold in California now move towards zero emissions, and another large fraction with ultra-low emissions, so that you can be using hybrid cars like the Toyota Prius and the Honda Insight. Were it not for that regulation by a regulatory agency in the state with the largest automobile fleet in the world of any sort of unit of government, there would be no fuel cell research, probably the most exciting technological development and the key building stone for moving toward a hydrogen economy, something where billions of dollars are being spent by Ford, by Daimler, Chrysler, by General Motors, by Mitsubishi, by Allied Signal. All of that would not be happening but for this regulatory agency saying this is the future that we want to have for our kids. And then the political support of the California legislature and governors behind it. So in area after area, whether you're trying to clean up the air or whether you're trying to push out technology, government has been crucial. To take sort of my favorite example, I won't ramble on forever on this one, but this is one I want to make sure I get in. It was decisions by the federal government to buy basically computer chips for the space program and particularly for defense that drove down the costs through economies of mass production that brought in the electronic revolutions, the communication revolution. But for the federal government being willing to buy chips at $100 a chip and drive it down a learning curve to the point where they cost less than a dollar a chip, we would not have had all of the technology that now powers a robust economy.
There, particularly in the last few years, has been a tendency to say the government is the problem, and that what needs to happen is that we just need to let private industry do what private industry does. You mentioned chips. The internet is obviously another example. Many of the things that we characterize as being key ingredients of the so-called new economy, whether it exists or not, the economy is doing fairly well. But a lot of those came out of government-sponsored research, and a lot of those were a direct response to public policy.
Yeah, I mean, there are things that industry does far better, far more efficiently, far more creatively than government, and there are things that government does better than industry, and I wish that there wasn't this constant tension, but maybe even that tension has some creativity in it. In my view, the proper role of government is to set the ground rules, to find out, this is how much pollution you're allowed to. These are toxic things that you are simply not allowed to let into the environment, to basically establish the parameters within which the marketplace can function. And that sometimes will include price. I mean, if there are huge environmental costs attached with the generation of carbon dioxide that are not reflected in the cost of carbon fuels, then the government ought to be able to put those something on a tax, a tariff, an import quota, something that internalizes that external cost, much as Europe has, or Japan has, the whole rest of the world has, except the United States and Canada and Australia. And we'll get there, but it's an appropriate role. Only government can do it.
This is Dennis Hayes. We will come back in just a moment when Bill Russell will ask what is on the tip of his tongue here on The Paula Gordon Show. We hope that you'll be with us when we return.